Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebell at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm delighted to welcome Michael A. Olivas to discuss his new book, Perchance to Dream, A Legal and Political History of the Dream Act and DACA, published by NYU Press in 2020. Michael Olivas is the Emeritus William B. Bates Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Houston. His 16 books include many works on undocumented children and higher education law. His new and timely book provides a comprehensive history of DACA, insights into why the legislative version stalled at the federal level, and suggestions on how DACA might be protected. Welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thank you very much, Susan. I'm delighted to be here.
In the preface to the book, Bill Richardson writes of you that you were in immigration law before it was a field, and that you are, I quote him, not only one of our nation's leading experts in immigration law and history, but also one of the first. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how you became interested in immigration law and how this became your focus in your writing.
Well, it's interesting because about half the time when you interview for a position, they ask you what you want to teach and you give them A, B, and C. For me, I actually was recruited at the University of Houston Law Center to start up a higher education program. And so I had specialized in higher education law, which had been my dissertation topic as well. But one of my favorite classes in law school at Georgetown was immigration. And the person who taught that class, Charles Gordon, had written the major treatise on immigration and had represented as general counsel the INS, what was then called the INS, for many years. I had also come to know the then current INS director, Leonel Castillo, who was from Houston. And at the time, I hadn't decided to go to Houston, but when I did, his wife helped me get my apartment. I became close friends. I ended up marrying a good friend of his who was chair of the board of the independent school district there. And so all these things sort of came together. I cultivated entertainment law late in life, turning a hobby into a business. But on immigration, I'd say virtually any Mexican-American has an interest, in part because we may have family still in Mexico. My family's been in the United States for a number of years, and so I know I have relatives in Mexico, but I don't really know them. And it's a lot of literally water under the bridge. So it was both an intellectual and a personal interest. And I've been very lucky because at the time, most law schools had only adjunct professors. When I say only, I mean did not have full-time professors. They had people who were practitioners who taught it on the side, as it did at the University of Houston. And so it was unusual. I was one of the very first to teach. And when I retired at the time, even though I was only 69, I was 68 when I retired, I was the senior professor. I'd been teaching the longest. In fact, they didn't even have case books. Now, of course, it's become a completely different universe. There's case books and concordances and the like. In fact, there's competing case books. So I was fortunate to be at the front end of that field and in higher ed law. There was no active case book at the time in that field. And the person who had written the original case book had been appointed to the federal bench. So he was no longer publishing the case book. So I tried to convince others to do it, and I ended up plunging into that field. But had I gotten, had things been slightly different, I might have written the case book in this field. I'm very happy that I always had excellent case book materials, and there's so many other cases that my students always had interesting material, and almost daily I get things to clip or to respond to in immigration, higher ed law, sometimes an overlap of those two, and then entertainment law. It's really a great world. For me, I played in it for a long time, and I'm very happy.
And we know that this book was published in 2020, but a lot has happened with DACA since then. And we'll devote some time in the podcast later so that you can weigh in on the recent Supreme Court decision and also how you see the future for DACA, either under a second Trump administration or under a Biden administration. But let's back up and talk a little bit about the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act, which most of us know as the DREAM Act or DACA. It was originally introduced in the U.S. Senate back in 2001. And at the time, people thought it would be easy for it to go through. It never passed, and it has never come through the federal legislature. It's been something that's been done by executive order. Your book asks us to back up in order to understand why DACA didn't happen, why the DREAM Act didn't happen at the legislative level. And so I was wondering if you could start us off with a little bit of background on how this came to be necessary, given residency requirements for in-state tuition, and how it and how different state legislatures came at this issue of undocumented minors who were trying to access higher education.
I go to bed every night praying somebody's going to ask me that question. So I'm delighted. I will say, however, because there's so many political scientists on here, that DACA was not an executive order. It was an act of prosecutorial discretion, which is a different legal classification. And so just to save you from all these irate political scientists calling in, saying it's not an executive order, I just want to correct that small piece. Otherwise, like Rachel Maddow always asks people, did I say it right? You absolutely said it right. The interesting thing about this particular case is that many of the original issues for students who were undocumented, and by undocumented, I mean did not have proper legal status in the United States. Sometimes that's unclear. It's not a straightforward determination where you can just sort of hold a thermometer up to their forehead and say, hey, he's documented, he's not. I had a client one time who had been born in the United States, but he didn't know that. He was born out of wedlock, and he was embarrassed, and he was a professor, and he asked me to help him become legalized, and I started looking and asked for some records. It turned out he was born in a L.A. hospital, and we found the records. There was his little feet in ink, and it changed his life. He grew up in Mexico. He was very Spanish dominant, but he was very articulate and accomplished. And it turned out he was a lifelong birthright citizen. He just didn't know it. And so that kind of thing can happen. And so lawyering often is a detective work or an English parlor mystery where, you know, it turns out Mr. Lopez did it in the hospital with a knife. You know, I mean, it's a lot of detective work and research. And that's one of the reasons I was attracted to this field. It turns out that the early cases were about, not about whether or not the students could actually be admitted into school. Many of these students, because they had immigrant striving parents who had brought them to the United States to make a life better for their children, even though it put them and the family at risk and they lived in the shadows, these kids would rise to the top. And in Houston one year, with 16 public high schools in the city that were in Mexican American parts of town, 12 of them had both had either the salutatorian or the salutatorian or the valedictorian. These kids, you know, were really quite phenomenal. And of course, they spoke Spanish because they were in, and it's not just Mexicans, of course, but where I lived in Houston, it was predominantly Mexicans. The kids grew up speaking Spanish because they spoke to their parents and their grandparents and other family members. But they were also very fluent in English. And of course, they were thrown immediately into English immersion classes. And this was a time early on when being undocumented really sort of didn't matter. It's hard to tell with a classroom filled with Martinez's and Gonzalez's and Olivas's who's documented, who's not. And the school teachers simply took it on as part of their task. But when I moved to Houston in 1982, it turned out that the Supreme Court had just decided Plyler versus Doe. And the question there was whether or not the institution, the state, could charge them tuition for free public education. It was supposed to be free public education. It turns out, of course, that the state did enable school districts to charge tuition or to bar them entirely. Most of them didn't. They just announced a tuition policy, and then the parents couldn't afford to send their kids to school. But the Supreme Court overruled that law in a very important decision, Plyler versus Doe, that had just been announced before I moved to Houston. And one of the people involved in that had been Leonel Castillo, who I'd met over the years in D.C. when I went to law school, and he was there. And that's considered widely the high watermark for immigrant rights in the United States. It held they could also establish domicile under traditional criteria, which means you live in a place that you consider to be your true permanent fixed abode. And so the decision overturned the state's actions. And since that time, there's never been a challenge that's gone beyond, say, the appeals court level. But once all these kids were allowed to stay in school, then the question becomes, what happens when Doe, the anonymous Mexican-Americans, wants to go to college? Because after all, attending even public schools, even bad public schools, as was the case in many of the neighborhoods in Houston, the ultimate is to go to college. And many of these kids were rising to the top, taking honors classes, even in some cases transferring so they could have honors classes or better science labs and the like. And the state of Texas began allowing them, sort of because there were so few, and so community colleges allowed them, and community colleges at the time didn't charge tuition so they could afford it. And it was easy there. It was in district. Even if you were undocumented, if you lived in the community college district, you could do so.
And my wife let me interrupt you for just a second, because I think some of our listeners won't necessarily understand the impact of Plyler. So the U.S. Constitution doesn't mention the word education. It doesn't guarantee a public education. And historically, education was something that was handled at the local or state level. But Plyler, and our listeners are more familiar with Brown v. Board of Education, in which there is some sort of sweeping language about the importance of education in terms of what was deprived of for citizens who couldn't access the same education under segregation. So can you just tell us just a tiny little bit about what Plyler said about education and why education was seen by the court as so fundamental?
Sure. And I'll remind your listeners, of course, that my book, No Undocumented Child Left Behind, is available in fine bookstores everywhere. Soon to be a major motion picture featuring Jimmy Smits as me because of the eerie resemblance that we have to each other. Well, now that I've clarified that, the interesting thing was at the time that the Texas legislature enacted this legislation, they didn't change the truancy laws. And so every student who was under the age of 16 who didn't have a medical reason, and at the time there was no homeschooling kind of thing for religious instruction, they were obligated to be in school. And so they were making criminals out of these parents by them not attending, if in fact they didn't attend. And as I say, there was very low enforcement at the time. It wasn't until this act was written in 1977 that school districts actually started paying attention to the immigration status of these kids, particularly along the border, where in some instances, in fairness to the record, parents lived in Mexico and would send their kids every morning to the schools. And the schools didn't mind it for the most part, as long as there was a small number, because they were paid on a what's called an average daily headcount basis. So every child you have, you get a certain amount of money for, and the more kids you have, the more money you'll get. So there was this kind of built-in resistance because the school districts often didn't enforce truancy, but they did if they found kids on the street or not attending school and the police found them hanging out in a street corner or shining shoes or something like that. So the real issue was that they were, on the one hand, required to be in school, and then on the other hand, were precluded from doing so by the tuition that was being charged. And by the way, in some school districts, it was $1,000. In 1982, that's a lot of money. I one time asked my students in class if any of them had $1,000 that they could access tomorrow, and only about three or four of them did, and they all said, I put it on a credit card. So, in other words, they built in this tension between going to school and not going to school. And of course, most of these kids would become United States citizens eventually, as the parents found means of legalizing themselves. And so the Supreme Court says in Plyler that this is simply residents gone amok, and determined that these children had the right to attend. Now, what that decision did, as generous as it was, if they said they were innocent children, by the way, they used the term innocent children. They also used the term undocumented for the first time. It's actually, as best I can tell, the first Supreme Court case that actually used the term undocumented. They also used illegal, but they also used undocumented. So that itself was important. And I think political scientists actually track these kinds of things. So you're very welcome for me doing your homework there. So the issue then became, because these kids were innocent, someone has to be guilty. And so the decision, when you read it really carefully, reflects a certain amount of, I won't say derision, but it demonizes parents. It was the parents who were the scofflaws, who committed the crime of bringing their children. The innocent children were brought in tow by the parents who had crossed the line. And this was at a time when border enforcement wasn't as strong as it is today. It wasn't until several years later that major legislation really addressed this issue with that famous liberal president, Ronald Reagan, who enacted in 1986 the Immigration Reform and Control Act. So what you have is permission for these kids, not just this kind of inchoate live and let live, but you had actual permission for these kids to attend public school. And in fact, the ongoing and never altered requirement that they do so. But they were going to college. They were going to college in small numbers. I began to meet a number of them in the community college, in part because my wife was president of the school board, which was a K-14 school board. It also had the Houston Community College as part of it. So they would meet in both capacities. And they weren't charging tuition, but they wanted to become independent. And at the time, they decided they had to have a tuition base. And so some of these kids began being charged tuition when they hadn't been charged before. And once they attended community college, they would just pass on their academic records. No one was asking for passports or immigration papers and the like. And it was just assumed that they were citizens. So they would go to the University of Houston or transfer to UT or to A&M or other schools, as their record allowed them to do. And it was a good time. It was an interim before everybody sort of discovered what was going on. And then changes in administration drew more attention to it, and there began to be a number of court cases, particularly in California, where you have a very tiered system. You've got the UC at the top, and then the Cal State in the middle, and then the community colleges. And there's 100, now there's about 120 community colleges. But even then, there weren't many students going through. One study at that time, about 1975, showed that there were only 3 undocumented students in the entire Cal State San Diego institution. Well, that's on the border. You'd think there'd be more of them, and there weren't. But the numbers began to rise after Plata versus Doe, and these kids started going to college, as I say, having the academic records to qualify them. And so they moved forward. And so there was at least, in my book, I record maybe 30 or so state cases all of it at the state level because it was state law being interpreted. We ended up at one time where they could go to the University of California, they couldn't go to Cal State schools, and they couldn't go to the community college. So if they could just make it all the way to the top, they could go to the university, they could go to Berkeley or something. Now, the interesting thing was that at the time, there was a big distinction between in-state and out-of-state. Texas at the time, in 1982, for undergraduates, charged $4 an hour. That's sort of hard to believe. But out-of-state was 10x. So whatever, by law, whatever in-state tuition was, it was 10 times for out-of-state tuition. And Texas was a major receiver state, not only undocumented persons, but also people coming from other places because of oil and just the growth of the state and low, frankly, low tuition as well, and some excellent schools. So all you had to do was be out of school for 12 months and apply. That would make you an in-state resident. And I began serving on the University of Houston's board that determined these cases. We would read about 300 appeals a year for someone who wanted to become an in-state student and not pay the 10x penalty. And so I began thinking of this as a scholarly subject. I early on started interviewing people, started scouring state statutes and the like, and published a couple of pieces where I got some attention from policymakers, because now that there were these kids were applying to schools across the country, particularly in the Southwest, but also in the Midwest and Chicago, where there are actually more Latinos in Illinois than are in my home state of New Mexico, and places with other Latino populations that weren't Mexican-American. Not so much in New York, because those are Puerto Ricans and they're citizens, of course, but many Cubans and others in Florida and in the Southeast and so forth. So I began getting calls, not only from judges, clerks, and the like, but from state officials in higher education, people at coordinating boards, and most importantly, at schools themselves on what they could do. Could they craft any kind of policy? And I discovered that there were, at the time, two federal laws or two sections of federal law on immigration, Section 1621 and 1623, that said the undocumented, and they didn't use that term, they said people who are not lawful, do not have lawful status in the United States, meaning they weren't permanent residents, they weren't on a visa, and they weren't citizens. So someone who's a dreamer, someone who's undocumented, that they could attend, they could receive public benefits such as tuition, but only if the state affirmatively passed passed law. Now, that in some states, tuition levels aren't governed by law. They're governed by, let's say, in New York or New Jersey and some other places, by state boards. In some cases, such as Michigan, even the institutions themselves made the determination. So Eastern Michigan might have a different policy than down the road from Ypsilanti, you'd have the University of Michigan, and they'd have a different rule. And so there's this crazy quilt. And I began working with legislatures and helped draft 8 state laws, state regulation laws and regulations, that 4 of which were challenged in court, and ended up winning every one of those cases, I'm proud to say. And now we have about 30 states or so that allow people who are undocumented in. Now, today it's been complicated by DACA-mented students. That's different, and I'll talk about that later when we get to that part of the story. But at the time, I was before 2012, which is when DACA was enacted.
So, yeah, and let me ask you just a little bit about those, what you're calling a crazy quilt, right? We have from the Supreme Court this idea of Brandeis, that these are going to be laboratories in which people will figure out these creative and ingenious things. But in the book, what you're showing is that at the state level, based on these incentives regarding tuition and these complicated rules about what establishes residence in order to access some of that tuition or tuition benefits or to access university at all, that we have this parallel set of politics playing out. And I was wondering if you just pull back the lens for a minute and make some sort of general comments about partisanship. Is this all coming from Democrats or all coming from Republicans? You've said a little bit about geography, but is this coming predominantly from one place, or would we be surprised to see what a state like Massachusetts, for example, might be doing. So to just give us a sense before we move on to the national fight as to whether this state patchwork was partisan and some just general patterns.
Well, it was interesting that at first it wasn't entirely partisan. In fact, Massachusetts didn't have enabling statutes, and I forget the name of the governor, a black guy. I'm just blanking on his name. He was a presidential candidate for about 5 minutes. Deval Patrick kept trying to enact it on his own authority. He couldn't get the legislature to do it. And as I said, in 1986, you've got this kind of moment of clarity where President Reagan parts the waters, and all of a sudden you've got not only a resolution of this, allowing both parents and children to become legalized under certain circumstances, but now you had employer sanctions, and it became both more and less partisan after that. The 1986 was probably the highlight in federal comprehensive immigration reform. It gave us employer sanctions, which was a problem almost immediately, but it was a trade-off because millions of people ended up legalizing themselves. And so my life became doing workshops and training my students to go out and do workshops on how to become legalized. I remember families snaking around the buildings with lawn bags filled with papers. The term document is exactly the right word because you have to have some proof that you'd been there for a certain period of time. They would do checks for not having a record, those kinds of things. And so it became partisan about 1986 when, as I say, a conservative Republican president enacts legislation. And I thought by then that was pretty good. I mean, after all, I'd only been teaching at that time for 4 years. I thought, man, if this is happening early in my career, it could only get better. And of course, it didn't. Almost immediately, there was the thermodynamics of political science where he had an equal and opposite reaction. So in 1996, when Clinton was in office but was weak, had been weakened sometimes by just the nature of the changing of the guard in Congress, but also by his personal peccadilloes, they ended up passing two very important restrictionist statutes, nativist statutes that trimmed back some of the ambiguity, took away some discretion, made some things criminalized in a way. And it's been probably no better since then. Pre 1996, between 86 and 96, you had really the highlight. We had an increase in people who came out of the shadows. They turned out to be very good members of the community. Their children, of course, now became birthright citizens. Sometimes you'd have families before that were mixed status. You'd have the older ones who came over with the parents who were out of status. And then the ones born in the United States, even of undocumented parents, had birthright citizenship. And so those kids would more naturally be English fluent. They'd become the translators and negotiators for the families and the like. So you have partisanship at the national level, but at the state level, interestingly, these kids were so good and almost always good kids. That is, they knew that if something happened to them, they lived with their parents, and the immigration police would remove their parents. And so they had this ethos of being very law abiding, more so than U.S. born citizens in many instances. I remember one time going to school and seeing this car crash, and no one was around, but it was still steaming. And of course, it had to be undocumented drivers because states still didn't allow them to have old licenses or to drive or to own bank accounts. I mean, there are a lot of restrictions that occurred in real life, but in education, because of Plyler, these kids were sort of in a safe harbor, at least until they graduated. And while there were still some border skirmishes, kids who ran onto school districts, feet grounds, and they were arrested. Or in Albuquerque, there was sort of a really crazy case about some undocumented kids who were outside Del Norte High School, a name in Spanish, and they were arrested for looking like they were undocumented. Whatever that looks like, I defy the photographers who are listening now to tell me what someone who's undocumented looks like. So these kids tried to juke and stay out of the limelight. They would drive very cautiously, even though they couldn't, in some instances, could not have driver's licenses. They would take their parents around. The parents were continuing to work even with employer sanctions.
So let's focus on the national politics. So you've brought us to the two bills passed in 1996, signed by Clinton, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunities Reconciliation Act and the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 1996. As you say, they're passed in this very complicated national political atmosphere. Take us to 2001, when we have legislation that is introduced, legislation that sounds very much like what is being discussed now, and give us a sense of the extent to which this was supported by both parties, neither party, and why it didn't turn into law.
Yes, I'm glad that you spelled out what those were, because I usually go for both of those. So from the years 1996 until 2001 were very difficult for immigration practice, because we had this nativist, sort of rollbacks, and we thought things were going in the other direction. And then in 2001, where the very first state statute was enacted by Governor Perry, the successor to Governor Bush, where he said, if you've been here for 3 years, you get in-state tuition. That actually was passed before 9/11. And the introduction of the original DREAM Act was by, of all people, Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion, and Orrin Hatch, not so liberal a lion, from Utah. And it turns out, through some quirky meetings at one time, I found someone who had been on his staff and said, well, he's Mormon, and the Mormons do a lot of recruiting in Latin America and take a lot of missions there. And so the entire staff was for, Latinos, even though, of course, Latinos aren't the only documented population. But that's sort of a interesting backstory, don't you think, to how he, of all people, would arise. And, of course, he was not all for comprehensive immigration reform. He was taking it sort of a step at a time, to his credit. But the fact that the two of them introduced it led me to take any number of bets, including dinners, at NEMFA's in Houston, where I lost the bet, saying, man, with these two guys, it's just a matter of time. Well, yeah, I guess that's still technically true. It is still a matter of time. And both the House and the Senate have enacted versions, but never in the same Congress. And so I would just have it, the moons were, and here my hands are crossing each other in different directions. They had a little eclipse there, but never enough to be enacted into law. And then during the President Bush's first administration, before 9/11, there was some movement there to try and reconcile. He had been meeting with the President of Mexico, and in fact, there was a vote in his second term where it was very, very close. It passed the House, and the Senate needed 5 votes. But it turns out McCain was running for, Senator McCain was running for the presidency. So he was sort of out of commission on this. He didn't want to appear too supportive. Senator Boxer had fires in the state. She wasn't able to be there. A couple of others didn't show. I'm forgetting the name of the senator from Pennsylvania who was both a Republican and a Democrat and then switched fields. Specter, is that Senator Specter, said, well, I'm for this, but it's going to ruin the opportunity for comprehensive immigration reform if we do this. Well, so he voted no, and that was the game. They didn't have enough votes to enact it. And the White House sort of pushed him a little bit on that and said, well, we need comprehensive immigration reform, not doing this piecemeal. As of course, most of your listeners would know, doing something early on can be built on. It actually gets you the low-hanging fruit. So these kids, even then, were very widely supported by all polls. Even today, GOP polls show that 60% of GOP voters support not comprehensive enrichment reform, but the Dreamer Act. So these kids always had the support, both from the Supreme Court and then the sympathy of the various states. And now at the federal level, it rolled up that way. But it died because they said, well, the Dream Act would rule out comprehensive immigration reform, whereas I thought it would show how it's possible to do, and you could build on it. And of course, once these kids became 21, then they could petition for their parents anyway. So under immigration law, longstanding immigration law. So it was an opportunity lost and still hasn't been taken up. President Trump, of course, has blown hot and cold on this, saying he loves the Dreamers. And then he turns around and says they're all bad hombres. And, you know, he talks out of both sides of his mouth on that. And because he's not giving the signal, a positive signal, the Promise Act that had been passed by the House is still sitting on Senator McConnell's desk waiting for a wink and a nod from the president to move forward. And it hasn't. Now, if it turns out, just to flash forward for a moment, if DACA were actually canceled on President Trump's watch, there might be some movement there. That's the only sort of good thing that could come from that. There's been no movement. And these kids now, of course, 800,000 of them have some opportunities under DACA. But because it was cut off by the Trump administration, there's a building number of kids who are ineligible or who would have been eligible had it not been ruled as dead on arrival with the Trump administration. So I'd be glad to move to that direction because that's actually the sort of the next step in this saga. There continue to be cases, but by now about 30 states have enacted in-state tuition for undocumented persons. And almost all of them except New Mexico look like this. If you come to high school here and attend high school and graduate and spend 3 years here and you don't have any serious misdemeanors, then you can get in-state tuition. Well, that's the victory that we were seeking all those years. As I said, I was an expert in four different cases trying to do this piece by piece. But the problem with state benefits is that they're not transferable. They're not fungible. You can't carry them with you from one state to another. So if I go to high school and qualify in California and then try to go to school in Texas, I can't meet the Texas requirements except by waiting out 12 months, which I could do. But a lot of these students want to go sooner than that.
So before we turn to taking this to the present, the recent Supreme Court ruling in Department of Home Defense versus Regents of University of California, and also I would like to also ask you about the F-1 visa announcement by ICE this week.
Sure.
But before we do that, let me just ask you a general question about the press. So as I read the book, there were moments in which you seemed to feel that at both the state and federal level, progress wasn't made in a sense because the press never fully, in your words, sussed the legislation. They didn't understand what was at stake. They didn't understand these incredibly complicated terms, the difference between domicile and residence. So in general, how has the press fared in reporting this and have they helped? Have they hurt?
I was very glad for the opportunity to resurrect the term sussed, by the way, which is a term I've always loved, but never got to use it in a book. So I finally got that off my chest. There are a lot of moving parts. And there are, of course, and I'll take D.C. off the table just for a moment and Puerto Rico off and Guam and so forth off the table. 50 different states that had essentially 50 different sets of residence requirements. And so, and some of them were not only a crazy quilt, but some of them just didn't make legal sense and deserved challenge just on the poor draftsmanship. So a lot of them would use the term intention or other terms, your true permanent fixed abode, which are terms of domicile, which is actually different than what they really meant, which was duration. Even though none of them used the term duration, what they all meant was you have to be in the state for 12 months, cut all ties with other jurisdictions, commit yourself, and then you become an in-state resident. And no state had more than an 18-month waiting requirement. And these new Dreamer kids had even longer than that because they had 3 years. And that came about, and here all your listeners will get some insider baseball information. I met with some representatives from first Governor Bush's team, and then when he became president, his successor, Governor Perry. And they said, well, these kids are going to all come to here just to go to college. And I said, that's just not the way it works. There's no evidence that that's the pull factor. The pull factor is actually work for their parents, and they come along. And because of truancy laws, they're in school. And because the parents come here for the kids, they want them to be educated, and Plyler versus Doe allows that. So I was always able to point to Plyler as the background. But and they wanted to say, well, how about 10 years? That just seems reasonable. I said, well, no, the longest one right now for citizens is only 18 months. How about in Texas, most public schools have sophomore, junior, senior year, 3 years. How about if they have 3 years? That's still three times as much as for a citizen or someone from Louisiana or some other state. And they said, okay, that seems reasonable. And honestly, at that meeting in 2001, they bought that argument. And I think it was a fair argument, by the way. The only state I was able to convince to go with 12 months was New Mexico, because I knew Bill Richardson. My father had been his campaign manager. He was a good personal friend. And by then, things had changed. And so there was a growing counter movement among the states to become actually more accessible, in part because of the success of the kids who'd done so. So that was testimony. And in part because, again, with falling white birth rates and enrollments, many states were actually losing young kids. The United States acts as if having immigration is harmful, when in fact, we're one of the few developed countries where we improve the normal pyramid, which is having many more old people than young. Because once you become a citizen, once you become permanent, you end up having fewer kids as a rule. The more secure you are, the fewer kids you have. And so we were lucky to be replenished by these wonderfully talented kids who not only brought other skills, but other languages, and they were well-behaved because of immigrant resilience studies, right, and so forth with the Strivers. And so they were the perfect kinds of kids that you'd want, and they were achieving. They just had to pay these inordinate amounts of money to go to college, and they were always ineligible for federal assistance. They couldn't get
right. But at some level, it's not an ethical requirement to be better than the average citizen in order to access any sort of services. So setting up the requirement to be better than, to be exemplary as a citizen, also places a burden. Michael, I want to direct you to some of the things that have happened since this book was published. And I also want to talk a little bit about audience, because many of the listeners are trying to figure out whether this is a book that they need to read for their research or they need to assign to their students or lots of other possible uses. So let me first direct you to the recent court case. In this book, you highlight the importance of words and the meaning of very particular terms. In some ways, you sensitized me to be listening even more carefully to the way the press is reporting what is coming out of the Supreme Court and what has come out of ICE this week. So let's start with the Supreme Court. What for you was the impact of their recent decision saying that President Trump could not end the program given the way he had approached it and the reason that he had given? What do you see as the importance of this case?
Well, here I would urge your readers to not only buy my book and, of course, any book that you've produced, but also the book, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. Because if there is any apt description of the Trump administration with regard to not only his approach to law generally, but immigration in particular, where he, you know, routinely violates law and doesn't always get caught on it and makes it up as he goes along and imprisons kids and doesn't accord people their asylum rights and the like. In addition to all of that, which made it very difficult to teach immigration for the last couple of years, I was teaching kids the tools with a toolbox that kept opening and closing. But in fact, there are rules, and As it happens, Chief Justice Roberts is the most attuned to the application of the Administrative Procedure Act, which has been around for 70 plus years, which says that if you're going to undertake a formal action, as opposed to just we'll take this case versus that case, but if you're going to try and unravel a program that exists, especially one that has, in his words, had substantial reliance. After all, 800,000 kids were enrolled in DACA, and more would have been had it not been the spigot turned off years ago. They came to rely upon it, and they just sort of rolled over in bed and said, well, it's illegal. And Jeff Sessions has started this, and then all the various DHS acting secretaries. We've been through more acting people there than a minor league, you know, baseball team. Said it's illegal, and the president didn't have the discretion and the authority to do that. Now, this from a person, by the way, whose administration declares discretionary acts all the time. And the interesting thing was that President Obama, before he enacted this program in 2012, actually was called by some of my colleagues, and I suspect some of yours, as a deporter in chief. He'd been so successful in trying to remove people, his low-hanging fruit, people who were here with criminal acts on their record, or who were open and notorious, or who were well known to the authorities, and he removed 400,000 a year for each of his terms. That's an enormous amount of people being repatriated to their countries, and he was doing that to try and gin up support for comprehensive immigration reform, or at least a DREAM Act. And I have colleagues who called him, and students called him, the deporter in chief. And I refused to engage in that name calling because I knew what he was really trying to do. And he tried some projects, some experimental programs, one in Denver and another one's, I think, in North Carolina, where they offered low enforcement priority to people like students. Very few Dreamers had actually, you know, when they were caught for some reason, like sitting in Senator McCain's office and had felony charges of which they were convicted. They weren't removed. They were allowed to stay here. And it was only when a paper outed them or something or they became multiple offenders or took up crime, which very few of them did, that they were actually removed. And so there was always a low priority on enforcement. And you have to. It's just like, are we going to go after jaywalkers? Are we going to go after speeders? Are we going to go, you know, pick a crime that's a low level crime with small stakes, but that can have big consequences when you announce you can enforce it? Well, that's what they were doing with DACA, where they said we're just not going to use this anymore as a means of deportation. So they gave these kids, in effect, three different tools. One is a Social Security number, which, believe it or not, actually, it renders you eligible for a variety of benefits. They also had work authorization, a so-called EAD, Employment Authorization Document, which allowed them to work. And that, of course, is the key because a lot of these kids had to work and couldn't find work while they were going to college. It did not give them eligibility for Title IV, but it gave them what's called lawful presence. And that's as distinct from lawful status. Lawful status would have meant that they moved along the pathway to citizenship. They didn't get that. So it was really a buying of time. It was a safe harbor that could be renewed for as long as the program continued, for 2 years at a time. And then it was such a success, almost immediately it paid for itself. Immediately these kids started working, becoming licensed, you know, graduating from college, becoming doctors. In fact, the Supreme Court, while it was still considering DACA, received a report that a number of law professors and others have put together showing how over 20,000 of the Dreamers, of documented students, were involved in healthcare. So they were actually essential workers at the time. There's now a Dream Bar where you have either undocumented or documented lawyers because state statutes didn't ever anticipate there could be 800,000 of these kids presenting credentials. And so they poured into teaching fields and others. And many states, believe it or not, didn't have immigration eligibility. They would have terms, and listen to three of these and see if you remember them, Social Security numbers, the ability to work, or if you had lawful presence. If you had any of those, you could become a lawyer, a doctor, a school counselor, et cetera. And right. So DACA actually had provided this long-term benefit, and these kids, you know, lined up to take advantage of that. And so when the Trump administration said they were going to do away with it, they just rolled over in bed and decided it was illegal. And they said so, and that was their line. Now, the interesting thing is, and I'm on the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund board, so I see these cases up close. One of the Maldiv cases that we had won just prior was a census case, where the Census Bureau decided, for what I believe to be partisan reasons, to start asking immigration questions. They never asked that before. In fact, they had sort of interagency rules that when they were doing screening for Census Bureau, that they would ask that question, but they would not give the information to any other agency, which was breached, of course, by the Trump administration.
Right. So Michael, if I understand you correctly, and if I understand the book correctly, you're saying that the recent Supreme Court case really doesn't change anything fundamentally or substantially because it relied on the Administrative Procedures Act. It allows the president to come back and elaborate, specious or not, a set of justifications for ending the act, and he can do so. And then, again, if I understand the thesis of the book correctly, it will fall back to the states. So in the absence of national legislation, which is what we have been relying upon, this will be punted back to the states.
No, it really won't, because it doesn't determine in-state residents. So it's very bifurcated here. It doesn't have anything to do with any state benefit. It has to do with three features plus advanced parole, which means the ability to leave the country and return, that are all federal. You know, the states don't give you permission to work. They don't give you social security numbers. They don't give you lawful presence. They don't give you the ability to leave the country and enter. Those are all purely, quintessentially federal obligations and responsibilities. But what he could have done was done it properly. He could have shut it down properly. And there's rules for that. Notice and comment. They had not done those in the Census Bureau case either, which is why that case becomes important. And they had misrepresented it. They had said we're doing this to make better accountability or something. When in fact, through an interesting backstory that I won't bore you with, maybe it'll be my next book. It turns out they knew that it was a lie and that they were doing it for partisan reasons. They just papered it. And Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote that case also, holds that they did not follow the APA and that they had lied in it, misrepresented. Now, the only one who sussed that out was Justice Sotomayor. She actually, in this case, not only, agrees with Chief Justice's majority opinion, but she writes her own dissent or her own remarks saying this was done under false pretenses, because if you look at what candidate Trump said, where we're all bad hombres, et cetera, it was clearly done for nativist and racist reasons. Now, no one else joins her in that, but she, in my view, is so great at really getting to the bottom of perfidy. Maybe because she grew up in New York, and so she's seen the president, you know, operating all these years in murky territory. But she calls him out on that, and she says this is exactly like the case with the census where there was misrepresentation. Here they just didn't do it right, but he could have done it right. There's no doubt. And the question is whether or not he has enough time to do so before he leaves office.
And I agree with you that her concurrence, which is what it was the only one willing to take on whether the intent was racist. And it is fascinating that no other member of the court joined that concurrence, as well as signing the majority opinion by Justice Roberts. Let me, since we're almost out of time, let me ask you a little bit about what happened this week, which is the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, generally known as ICE, announced that for fall 2020, students from abroad with F-1 visas will have to take their classes in person. And that means that students who are at the many universities that have decided to go online will be facing very, very difficult choices. Do you have any thoughts on that announcement and the responses that are currently being made by universities?
Yes, I hope that someday we can very soon could have another podcast on this, because it's also a lot of moving parts on it. The real issue here is a return to the status quo ante. Until last April, I think it was, when they suspended the rules. After all, so many schools in midstream in the semester or the term switched to online instruction, including international students, of course. And it's not just Fs, but it's M1s as well. M1s are students coming here for vocational schools, who fill a lot of, or language instruction, they fill a lot of the programs as well. So students who are on non-immigrants who are on student visas, let's say, just to cover the waterfront, have never been allowed to come to the United States if they were taking entirely online courses. It makes no sense for someone in Slovenia to come to the United States if they're going to go to a trade school that has all its classes online. Why would they be? They could do that from Slovenia. They don't have to come to the United States. And because there's viewed to be X number of spots filled up by students who want to come, who are very qualified for regular programs, which can have a mix or a hybrid of online or other kinds of classes as well, but they can't take all of them that way. And a number of schools, as you know, including Harvard Law School, are going to have entirely online programs. That means they will not be able to allow any international students on these visas to attend. The problem isn't that rule was unfair, because I actually thought it was fair. I thought it was exploitative of schools to do this. And it was mostly trade schools. So it really was sort of consumer protection. It helped students who were going to take all their classes online anyway from having to come to the United States and do it when they could do it from there and still get the same credit. So I always thought it was fair. And it was fairly applied, too. And everybody lived with it. It's just that because of this emergency, they switched gears and said, we'll have an exception. And everybody sort of assumed that would last as long as there was this uncertainty in the waters being roiled by the pandemic. But it turns out that here it is, a month before some schools are starting anyway, they say no. Now you try and, come from Slovenia to the United States right now on a month's notice. You won't know what you can do when you get here. Some schools are clearly, in my view, going to start online, or start with hybrid, find out they can't do it because these kids just will not conform to the kind of, distancing rules that are necessary. It's clear now from their beach and bar behavior they won't do that, and they can't do it. How are you going to do it in a dormitory and so forth? So I think the rules are going to change, but then it'll be too late. I thought they should have let it roll out for another year and a half, but that would have meant this administration conceding that it doesn't have control of this pandemic. But it's part of a piece. They have the Muslim ban, which affects a lot of students. They have the rules about Chinese students not being members of the Communist Party. They have tried to do away with optional practical training, which allows immigrants to these students to work in internships after they graduate. They've cut back on the H programs, which mean you can't hire them even if they're graduates of U.S. schools. It's all part of an anti-immigrant tapestry that is the signature of this administration. It has been since the beginning with Bad Hombres. As I sign off with you, all I'll say is that I am the administration's worst fear. I'm a Mexican with a law license who can write. And people knowing about this is important. And that's why I wrote the book. I tried to elevate out of the shadows these important cases that had occurred that most people didn't know about unless they knew one of these kids. And these kids are our glory. They're our treasure. We've had them since Play versus Doe. We've invested in them. They have no more contact with their home countries. This is their home country. And we need to make a place for them. We can't deport 800,000 of these dreamers. That's absurd. And I think the only result, if Trump wins and does away properly, finally learns how to use the APA, there may be some backlash. But I'd sure hate to make book on that because I don't see a veto-proof Senate, even if it turns majority Democrat. But I will say this. I studied to be a Catholic priest for 8 years, and I believe anybody can be saved. Turned out I was much better at afflicting the comfortable than ever was it comforting the afflicted. I believe we're going to prevail. We'll not merely survive. We will prevail on this because the arc of history is our country is a beacon to the rest of the world. And we have squandered that for 4 years. These kids will go elsewhere, Canada, Australia, other places. We'll take them in a heartbeat and it'll make it easy and we will lose them. And this is the greatest gift we have, is to allow people to come here, go to school, learn our system, learn that part of being in that system is resistance. So I thank you very much for the opportunity. I hope that your authors will, your listeners, if they have questions, will drop me a note, correct the record. And I will end on this thought. ABBA does not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's another thing that I'm trying to get Biden's views on that. That's going to determine how I vote. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Michael, for taking the time to discuss the book with us. For the audience, this is a book that is wide-ranging. It has almost half of the book is notes, appendages, bibliography. It's exceptionally carefully done so that on the one hand, it is accessible to the general reader. On the other hand, it is a phenomenal research tool. The book is Perchance to Dream, A Legal and Political History of the Dream Act and DACA by Michael Olivas, and it's published by NYU Press in 2020. Thank you so much for being my guest today, Michael.
Thank you, Susan. I was very pleased to do so.